This morning, our Dharma talk will be given by Senior Dharma Teacher Alan Richardson.
It's always interesting to move up to the front of the Zendo and sit with the teachers for a bit and see the Zendo as they see it. And one of the things that I see from up here is that the big Mukugyo at the other end of the Zendo by the altar, the big fish drum, which is modeled on a fish, is swimming away from us as though it's desperately trying to get out of the Zendo, maybe before someone hits it again. And I can understand that urge to swim away at this moment. But here we are. And at the same time, I'm very happy to have this chance to talk with you here at the Coming and Going Sesshin. I've been enjoying slowly getting to know the new 30 pages, count them, of riches in the expanded sutra book. And I've been especially happy to see so many texts that we didn't have before by women teachers, which makes the sutra book so much more human and representative, and I think so much more fitting to our American Zen, in which women teachers have played such a large and crucial role. And among all these texts, there's one I was especially happy to see, and I will admit it that this is for egotistical reasons, because it was a text that I introduced Josh to, and then Josh put this into the sutra book, so I have a little ego thrill every time I see it. And this is the beautiful poem that we read together today during the sutra service by Izumi Shikibu. But really, I'm happy to see it there. The main reason is because Izumi Shikibu has become so important to me as one of the poets I really treasure and value. And just based on it, the handful of poems that I've gotten to know over the last few years, I had not heard of her before a few years ago. And I discovered her because I teach a course at Boston College called The Literature of Zen. And I was trying to find more texts by women poets for that course. And as you can imagine, in the standard anthologies, there are very few. In fact, in the anthology we use, which is a great anthology, The Poetry of Zen, it has a Chinese section and a Japanese section. There's exactly one poem by a Chinese woman, and there's exactly one poem by a Japanese woman. And so there was not much to start with. But I found this wonderful book by Jane Hirschfield, who is an important American poet and longtime Zen practitioner. And that's a different Dharma talk. But Jane Hirschfield, someone I really admire, and she had done an anthology, edited it, and done or co-done some of the translations called Women in Praise of the Sacred. And that's where I found Izumi Shikibu. And so let me start by reading that poem to you again. The Way I Must Enter. The way I must enter leads through darkness to darkness. O moon above the mountain's rim, please shine a little further on my path. So Izumi Shikibu was one of the greatest of all Japanese poets, and perhaps the greatest woman poet from the Japanese tradition. And just to give you a sense of her greatness, I'd like to read a couple of her other poems before moving back to that one that we have in our sutra book. And I'll tell you the few facts I know about her, which I know from Jane Hirschfield's wonderful introductory note. And one is that she was a 10th century poet, which means that she was living and writing her poetry before Zen had really been established in Japan, which was not till the 12th century. And yet, as you'll see, her poetry very much speaks to our tradition and helps me understand why Japan was such a fertile ground for Zen when it was brought back properly by Dogen and others in the 12th century. She was a court lady. She was a companion to the empress. which means that she was in, you know, the equivalent of the top one of the top 1% in a country where there was still periodical famines and poverty was real and pervasive, and she got to lead this very luxurious life, and yet she devoted herself not to pleasure but to poetry and to Buddhist practice, and she would go to mountain hermitages and practice as a alternative and escape from court life, but she would go back until after a time. And in court, she was quite notorious, not only well known for her poetry, most of which was erotic poetry, but for her erotic life. She was married at a young age, but then, as Jane Hirschfield puts it, soon created a great scandal when she abandoned her husband to begin a relationship with the emperor's son. And when the emperor's son died, she began a relationship with his brother, who lived for 5 years and so was involved with two sons of the empress. And you can imagine what that did for her reputation. And you can imagine the kinds of passions involved at a time when this probably was, you know, risking one's life if political currents just shifted a little bit. But she managed to get through all the court intrigues and all the political intrigues and had many other intense erotic affairs before finally marrying again and moving away from the capital. And then that part of her life was over. So as a lay Buddhist, I really appreciate having this example of someone that not simply lived a lay life, but really threw herself into passionate sexuality. This is not something that we talk about a lot, and yet this is one way that we practice, practicing with our full lives, our full bodies. And if we are lay Buddhists, then this may be part of it. And what I love about her poetry is it shows that this was no obstacle to keen understanding of Buddhism and clearly a sincere and deeply committed life of practice is reflected in her poetry. So she really exemplifies for us this non-dualistic way of thinking about our lay practices here in 21st century America. So let me just read, as I promised you, a few of these poems before I go back to the one that's in our sutra book. And here is the first one. I cannot say which is which. The glowing plum blossom is the spring night's moon. And so I'm not going to try to sneak in a Dharma talk on each poem, but I'll just say that for me, the way into that poem is in the Dendro Koan, which we read earlier, and where Dogen, Zen Master Dogen, tells us that uses the same image, only in this case the enlightenment is like the moon reflected in the water. And then he says, the whole moon and the entire sky are reflected in dewdrops on the grass, or even in one drop of water. And so two centuries later, he comes up with a similar image. And I just, to invite you to appreciate this poem on your own, I just want to say that for me, this is such an interesting difference, the moon reflected in a drop of water in Dogen, and the moon glowing on a single plum blossom in Izumi. I find this such a rich difference. So another poem about the moon. Most of these lyrics mention the moon. And the moon always means what it means in Dogen. It means enlightenment, and it means our Buddha nature. Watching the moon at midnight, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. So the power of this poem for me is in that last line, no part left out. And I'll just say before moving on that it took me years of Zen practice to realize that I did not need to cut out parts of myself. And that, in fact, what our practice demands is that we bring our entire self to it. Even the parts that we think we don't like, even the parts that we think we need to lose along the way. In our early fantasies of Zen practice, we think we'll become someone else and better. But that's not an option. And Izumi expresses that so well, I think. So another one. This one is the favorite of my students. Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight also leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house. So I love this one too. And 1,000 years later, a Canadian poet and Zen practitioner would say or sing, "There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." So how wonderful that Leonard Cohen independently, you know, reinvented this beautiful idea of the cracks between the roof planks of our ruined houses that let the moonlight in. And we all live in ruined houses, and how fortunate that we can't ever patch them up. We can't ever seal ourselves off the way that we sometimes wish to. And as a result, our leaky roofs are always going to be open to the moon. And so now I'll come back to the one that's in our sutra book and that I started with. The way I must enter leads through darkness to darkness. O moon above the mountain's rim, please shine a little further on my path. So when I presented these poems at the Greater Boston Zen Center, we were talking in the Dharma Dialogue about different reactions people had to the different poems, and I talked about them all more equally, and one other too on that occasion. And Carol Morley, who unlike me is an East Asian scholar and can read these in the original and knew all about Izumi Shikibu. Carol, my fellow senior Dharma teacher, mentioned that this was one of her best-known poems. And I asked her why, and Carol said that this is widely taken to be her death poem, which is really interesting, right? And there's a tradition that comes up in various Buddhist cultures, which is that when a Zen teacher or a Zen poet knows that death is near, then they write a poem. So you might want to think about that when your own death watch starts. Oh, great, now I have to write a damn poem. And I can't procrastinate. So it did not occur to me until Carol mentioned that this poem was about death. And I love it as a death poem. That really opened up another facet of it for me. And I remember a few months before my father died, when he knew death was coming and wasn't speaking very much, he said to me once, this is one of the last really memorable things he said to me. He said, "I know there's something I have to do, but I don't know how to do it." And so I think Izumi Shikibu really captures that sense. You know, none of us has a manual. None of us can talk to anyone. So how did you do it? What did you do when this happened? So the way I must enter leads through darkness to darkness. And yet there's something. O moon above the mountain's rim, please shine a little further on my path. There's still some glimmer that guides us, that we can find not from any other person, but from that same Buddha nature that is evoked in the other poems about the moon. I had read this initially, and I still do, because the wonderful thing about poetry is we don't have to choose which reading we like. We can have several ones, and they can all coexist happily together. The reading that I started with was when a Chinese or Japanese poem says the way, then I always think, oh, the way, the Buddha way, the Tao. And it really speaks to me in that sense too, the way I must enter, this way that we're all on together, this path that we're walking together, the way I must enter leads through darkness to darkness. So yeah, doesn't it? It leads through darkness. You come to Boundless Way Temple, and there are these wonderful teachers here, and you think they're going to tell you how to do this. And then what they tell you is, oh no, we can't tell you how to do this. You have to figure it out. There's we can give you a few, you know, encouragements, and we can tell you when we think you're just way off, but, you know, no. There's no rule book. There's no guidelines. If there were, there'd be a little book, How to Become Enlightened. We'd all read it, and, you know, we wouldn't have to come here at all. But that can't be done. So our way is through darkness, and that's what I understood Izumi to be telling us. That every step of the way is like walking on a path that we can't see. And we're not sure where the next footfall will land. And we're not sure where a drop-off's going to be and where a wall's going to be. And we just keep resolutely going forward, just feeling our way and using our intuition. And it leads through darkness to darkness. We talked a little bit yesterday in the Dharma dialogue about what various traditions term the great night of the soul, the great darkness of the soul. And the funny thing in Zen, as I understand our practice, the funny thing in Zen is that the great night of the soul does not open up into some beatific vision where everything is suddenly clear. We don't get to see the face of God. That's not on offer. And, you know, if you were to talk to one of your friends about your retreat experience, and they might say, well, that sounds like a lot of time you're putting into this and a lot of physical pain even sometimes. So what's the goal? What's it all for? And you can, oh, you know, emptiness, no self, stuff like that. You know, oh, great. Where do I sign up? You know, it just doesn't sound that attractive. We don't get to advertise some wonderful sense. We don't even get oneness with the universe, or not the oneness anyway that's supposed to two-ness. If it's a oneness, it's a oneness that doesn't exclude two-ness. And that's very different than what almost every other spiritual practice offers. And generally there is something other than darkness at the end. But I'm not so sure in this case. So when she says leads through darkness to darkness, it really speaks to me in my own practice and my own efforts to stay on the path without very much in the way of guideposts and even lighting. But there is this light she talks about, O moon, above the mountain's rim. So when I read that image, I always make images as I read poetry, and this is what I teach my students to do, and this is what I recommend to all of you, because most poetry was written with the idea that we would make images as we read. And so it's a way of realizing the poetry, not just understanding it, but realizing it. And so when I make that image of the moon above the mountain's rim, I see just that last sliver of moon left as the moon is dropping behind a ridge. There's just a little bit left, but it's giving just enough light to keep moving forward. It's barely enough light, and yet it's also just enough light. So it's kind of in the spirit of our term, Oryoki, just enough. It's no more than we need, but it's exactly what we need. And this is how the practice often feels to me. It's just enough. nothing extra. Just we talked yesterday about great doubt, and this is the great faith element of our practice. There's no magical book of which every word is taken to be true. There's no one that we can go to who has infallible authority, but there's just enough light to move on by. And so she says, please shine a little farther on my path. Just a little bit longer. And it always seems that way to me, that each day, just a little further on the path, another half step, and that's enough for this day. And so also, this poem to me is a poem about living a human life. And maybe that goes without saying, if it's a poem about being on the Zen path, then it's also a poem about leading a human life. And to me, this really speaks to any human being, just getting through the day, not necessarily on a spiritual path. The way I must enter leads through darkness to darkness, right? So what's at the end for us of human life? Death. Right? Darkness. This too is not an option. We don't get any other conclusion but that. And what's the process like? A lot of it is very dark. Lots of uncertainty in life. Lots of things that we don't know and that we will never know and that no one could know. Including the things that often seem most important to us. We just can't know. What's that other person thinking? Never know. What am I really thinking? What's really in my heart? We get these glimmers and these gleams of dim moonlight, but we don't get full knowledge. How interesting to be a human being and to have consciousness, but have consciousness of so much that we can't be conscious of. Please shine a little further on my path. So I was interested to notice, I hadn't noticed this before when I was looking at the sutra book, I was interested to notice that for this poem, which is not a sutra or a gatha or a dharani, it's a poem, that we are asked to put our hands in gassho, which is pretty rare in the sutra book and usually reserved for things like vows and gathas of repentance. And so I think that Josh must and the other teachers who put the sutra book together must have seen that aspirational quality of this poem, and that we really are bowing to something greater than ourselves, but it's something that we can only find within ourselves. That moonlight that we barely see over the ridgeline is actually emanating from someplace inside. So let me end by reading the poem to you one last time and inviting you to experience it at all those different levels and understand it in multiple ways at the same time and make the beautiful image as I read it. The way I must enter leads through darkness to darkness. O moon above the mountain's rim, please shine a little further on my path.
So please make yourselves comfortable, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue now. And this is a time for coming forth with questions, observations, and it can be about Alan's beautiful talk or anything to do with our practice.
Carol?
I'm missing one word, but would you like the poem in Japanese?
Yeah.
Kuraki no kuraki michi ni in. I'm sorry. Kuraki yori kuraki michi ni ininu beki. Haruka haruka ni terase yama no kiwa no tsuki. So the beginning of it, kuraki yori kuraki michi, from darkness to darker to darker. Kuraki michi, so from darkness to a darker path. Ininu beki, it must be entered, and I'm taking the eye out because there's no eye.
Right.
When Hirschfeld translated it, she made it into very much a eye and
right.
Please and so on. And then haruka ni terase, oh shine far, far into the distances of haruka. So she added the even further. And then yama no, and the little one I'm missing is the edge. I think it's kiwa, but I'm not sure. So yama no kiwa no tsuki, and ends with moon. So on the mountain's edge moon.
Wow. Wow, how beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Carol. And would you like to say anything?
I really did enjoy all the balance issues.
Would you like to say anything more about it?
No, just that I was really pleased that you saw the, that you brought in the Zen understanding that she already had. Mahayana Buddhism had come into Japan, but no Zen or Chan, as far as I know, in the 900s, late 900s. So that she, through her own sensibility, had already had these realizations, and in particular that in that poem and in the poem about the moon. I was really happy to hear you say those things.
Thank you, Carol.
Really spoke to me. I've been in a really defiant place lately, just with my fists and stomping my feet, just kind of screaming to myself throughout meditation and walking, like, I will not become a fucking Buddhist. That's where I am. I will not slap on an identity and block that crack in my house. I will not put more on it, you know, and I'm really just, like, kind of feeling there with it. And so this just... what's so funny in all of it, you know, I feel the same way with my koans. Like, I will not wrap myself up and put a bow and give you another presentation. Like, I'm done, you know? And I felt like every time I'm thinking that, every speaker, everything that's brought in here is just more permission within the practice for that, you know? And so exactly what you kind of talked about just in this, you know, this poet's history, her own, what she brought, just in these, in the poems of the cracks of the way the light gets in, you know, every time this defiance come up, it's like, well, that's allowed, you know, more permission given. And so it's like, just welcome, you know, all of it. And so it's hard to keep having it when it keeps being allowed, but, thank you.
Yeah, it, you know, I was struck by what you said, Alan, about Zen has taught you that there are no parts of you that can't be included in the wholeness of you. And this is a very similar understanding that everything we do, including defiance, being fake, being sad, arrogant, happy, it doesn't matter what's going on, confused, absolutely lost. It's all part of it. And anytime we try to run away from it or try to fix it, that's included too. Look, there's no way out. And that's quite radical. in a world that we've grown to understand has all these rules and regulations, we have formality around this amazing interior openness. And that's part of the gift. Nothing to push against.
And if I could add something from my experience, it's not just that those parts can be included, but what I've discovered is they have to be. Mm-hmm. You know, the very ones that I thought that I could somehow just lock them off through really hard practice, you know, but those are the ones that I need.
And so then as the energy of defiance arises, how to burn with defiance? You know, that and as we were saying last night, trusting the gift, you know, unconditionally accepting what each moment has to offer. So then when defiance arises, it's not a mistake. It is this incredible aliveness of life that can tangle us up if we get caught in the story of it. Mm-hmm. And then we can go endlessly round with it. But as we can burn with it and just be that, then it transforms us, you know, and we so need these, and I would even call them dark energies, you know, these things, I don't want to be defiant anymore, I don't want to be angry, I don't want to, but these are the engine, this is the rocket fuel that is so much stronger than our willpower, you know, some intellect, well, I'm going to try really hard today. Because, you know, it's the middle of Sesshin and I've got to, you know. But these things arise as gifts from beyond. And some are very hard to chew. They chew us up. And that's the gift.
Alan, thank you so much. I'm so glad to have you here today with us. And thank you for your efforts to find poems by women. I appreciate that. And I also want to thank Carol for her beautiful translation. And the line that really grabbed me was from darkness to a darker place, it must be entered. What it made me think of was the five remembrances. That you know, there are these facts of the matter of what it is to be human. This being sick and growing old and dying. And I love the passion in that it must be entered, and the invitation. It must be entered. You know, something we must do, and not knowing how to do it. Like, I love when you said, you know, we don't get to ask anybody, like, oh, how did you do it? You know, I have a lot of opportunity these past years to visit my mother, who is very ill, and be around a lot of people that are in the process of dying, as we are all in the process of dying, but these people are a lot closer. And some of them actually have died while I'm there. And seeing that, from my view, that the process is as unique to each of us as our lives are. That there's no pattern of, oh yeah, you're going to die that way. It just doesn't go that way. And this sort of really, for me, this really settling in to this knowing that, I'm going to die. Mm. And for me, what arises from that is a renewed gratitude and appreciation for the moment I have right now.
So, thank you so much, Laura. And I love bringing in the five remembrances, you know, in terms of the darkness after darkness that we live through. And also, and so implicit in what you said, this practice of turning towards the things that we spent years of our lives desperately trying to turn away from. And of course, you can't. They're going to come find you. You know?
Yes.
So then turning towards becomes this wonderful practice of actually learning to be friends with sickness, old age, and dying. And when you were talking about visiting, you know, at a place, a hospice or a place where people are dying, what I think I learned from going through this with my dad was that one of the great gifts you can give to someone who's dying is to turn towards them. You know, which is hard for people to do, I discovered. And so what a nice example you must be setting for everyone there.
And I just want to pick up on the darkness too, because in Zen imagery, darkness is also an image for oneness,
mm-hmm.
For the fullness, the boundlessness. And so I guess I want to pick a fight a little bit about the seeing the face of God. Because I think we do.
Yeah.
We do see the face of God.
Yes.
We see it in the leaf on the ground. We see it in the cry of the pain. That this darkness is beyond our conception. It is necessary to die.
Mm.
Just like the Christian tradition says. And I think in the Zen it's the same thing. We're encouraged to die moment after moment to everything we believe. Even Buddhism, we must die to Buddhism. If we hold on to Buddhism or Zen, we just get more stinky, and then we use too much air freshener in the bathroom. Get in trouble with our shoe soap. But it is necessary, and then entering that darkness, we find the darkness is not what we thought, not the binary darkness, but the great darkness that is nothing other than the great tenderness of everything. Not keeping anything out. This to me is the face of God. Yeah. So.
Thank you, David. Jenny.
When we were reading that Kenjo Koan, I know I've read it many times before, but just the thing about the drop of water in the whole sky and the drop of water was really vivid. Mm. To me today, and as you were talking, I was really literal, like not any meaning to it or anything, just seeing the whole sky and all the treetops and the drop of water. And when you were talking, I got this other image of after I'd been on a really long hike, and I was trying to get to a certain place and end the hike at. Exactly 6 months, so I was hiking well into the darkness and through the woods and looking for the blazes, and I came out into this grassy area, and there were all these foot lockers all placed all over this hill, and it was really strange. And then as I got closer, I saw that they were cattle. They were laying down.
Wow.
They were like Holstein cattle that were reflecting these weird patterns, and they were all watching me come out. No meaning to it or anything. It just it came to me really.
Yeah.
It was really.
What a great experience.
Yeah.
From dark cow to dark cow.
So,
yeah.
Bringing that.
And you know, I really want to respond to how you were talking about. So it was literal now, right? Literally. And so, you know, this walking literally on a path, which we've both done, you know, it has so much to do with our practice and in a kind of mysterious way. And it's not that you have to do it, but if you get the chance, if you are fortunate enough to be able to take, you know, long journeys on foot, which a lot of our Zen ancestors did, mm-hmm. You know, there's something about that experience that I think really resonates with our practice and really feeds it. So I'm really happy you got to do that, Jenny.
There's also a very important point that you implicitly made just now about direct experience. You know, in poetry, literature, human beings have associative minds. Most of us, not all of us, but many of us do, where we see a peach blossom and, you know, we associate to some meaning in it. We see the moon, the darkness, all these things. But ultimately, what starts to happen in practice is that the associations drop away and it's absolutely the thing itself with nothing intervening. You know, and then we can evoke some meanings, but you know, if it's a cow, it's fully a cow. Right? And we think, oh, you know, the water buffalo means blah blah blah, and the moon means blah blah blah. All true, all beautiful, all wonderful. That's art. That's Zen art. And such a relief, those of you who've experienced it after a lifetime of trying to make meaning out of everything, to just be present to the thing itself. Not like, you know, the taste of the oatmeal. Oh, yes, this reminds me of some perfume. No. Oatmeal, mouth, chew, swallow. That's it. I think we sometimes get lost a little bit in making meaning when the whole world is offering itself to us in the form of. And I guess that's my somewhat entry point into this face of God business. So because we're metaphor-making animals, we will have this direct experience and then package it. And that we're doing it for millennia. I know. Let's organize this thing. That was that thing that I just experienced where I really saw the cow. Oh, that was the face of God and the cow. And then we're off again. It's very hard not to go down that path. So, so face of God, cow eyes looking at you. Just the mind making meaning. So maybe with that, we'll go on to more zazen.